Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Overnight America, we continue, and oh boy, got a lot to talk to with Rich Rubino, which we'll get to in just a moment. I'm still pretty sore. I had to do some work on my car today, and we have two vehicles, and we have one that's a nice vehicle and one that's a not-so-nice vehicle. The not-so-nice one is what I refer to as my car, and I had to do some repairs on it today, and it was a pretty easy repair. I'm just so cheap. I refuse to take my car to the shop if it's something that I feel like I can do on my own. I feel like it's if it's a convenience thing, I just don't want to deal with having to pay all that extra money for a convenience thing. If it's something that could take me a few hours out in the garage, even if I'm a little bit unsure of what I'm going to do next. Like, I have a Band-Aid on my index finger after hitting it with a screwdriver trying to get a part loose. And I find that half of my struggles with doing my own car repairs, and something I haven't done before in the past, is with one of two things. One, something's not moving that should move, and I haven't figured out how to get it out of the way. Or number two, there's a stupid clip somewhere, and it's not releasing. So there's like a little connector clip when there are like two wires going to a certain spot or whatever, and I can't get the connector loose. And I find that I probably spend what should be all of 3 seconds to remove this clip, all of a sudden turns into about 15 to 20 minutes as I try everything I can until I finally reverse engineer the thing, and it's stupid easy, and I'm so ashamed it took me that long to figure it out. Well, I had a couple of those moments today. But on my car, I have an Envoy, and it has a six spark plugs. It's a six cylinder, and one of the coils went bad, the ignition coils, and I had to replace the ignition coil, which kind of looks like those landscaping lights that you buy at a hardware store, the ones that have the little solar panels on top and you stick into the ground and, you know, collects the sun, and then at night it has the light, and it kind of, you know, that's not really enough to use as a flashlight, but it's enough to, you know, light the way if you have a little path. It's kind of nice. So I had to replace one of those, and I figured it out. Okay, it's $20. I go online to buy the ignition coil. I buy a set of spark plugs, six of them, just because I thought, you know, I might as well just replace them all while I have it off. It'll take me a couple hours to do this thing. I knew if I were going to take it into the shop, that's probably about a $300 job. And I thought, okay, I can buy it all for $50. Or I can go to the shop and have them do it for $300. No, thank you. So I just did it in the garage today. The only thing that happened is I kind of sliced my finger a little bit, but that'll repair itself. I'll let the body handle that sort of thing. But one of those days, and I realize I'm way out of shape when I try to bend over into the engine working on things. It's not like when I was younger where you can just do a million things a day. Man, I am getting old. Oh, John calling in from University City. Hey, John.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm all right, just sore, but I'm all right. What's going on?
Oh, way to go, buddy. Good trying, you know.
Good trying.
I had an old 1998 Pathfinder, and Nissan Pathfinder with about 260,000 miles. And because of the state Missouri laws, I had to pass inspection every 2 years. And I always had error codes that popped up, and it was frustrating, and I always went to AutoZone, and they always read off exactly what parts you needed. And then you could either do one or two things. You could go out to YouTube and figure out, once you got the error, like which part needed to be replaced.
Yep.
Go out to YouTube to watch it, and several videos there. There's always a lot of them. And or you can go to a mechanic. If you have a mechanic friend, he can print off all of those exact, it's like one through steps, one through, whatever it takes to get the part replaced. And it'll show you how many hours it'll take to replace it. I did that for years and years, trying to pass inspection for this old Pathfinder. I finally replaced it with a new 2018 Maxima, which I'm not going to have to ever worry about again. But I'll tell you, I'm with you on that. I try to get mine always fixed if I can myself.
So you got it up to 200 and some thousand miles?
260,000 miles. Right. And, you know, I did the oil. The key is always do your oil changes at every 3,000 miles. And especially the older the car is, don't put the synthetics in there. The idea is to keep the oil filter clean, you know, of course, and then keep the oil flushed out because the old engines have a lot of metal parts in there.
Oh, yeah, the shavings and things.
Every oil change, every 3,000 miles, is just do that religiously, and your car, that's about all you need for a car to last 250,000 miles.
Yeah, outside
regular
of the
oil
other
changes.
Outside of the other things from just happening to brake on it, I'm sure, you know, there's little things that pop up, but a lot of these vehicles, they're designed for you to swap out the parts, except for these newer vehicles that make it such a hassle. So you know, the newer vehicles, it's sometimes impossible to get to some of these parts. It's almost like you have to take it into a mechanic, and that's what's frustrating.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, some of them you just have to.
Were you trying to get to 300,000 on that Pathfinder? Not Pathfinder.
I was, but I'll tell you what, I had a problem with my front, like the drive shaft, and it was causing me to almost go over to the right a lot. I was spray hitting telephone poles and trees.
Oh, no.
And I drove that thing to the last mile, sir. I honestly did.
I love that feeling that you were able to.
But Nissan's a good car, and I bought another one.
Oh, there you go. All right. Thanks for that, John. Have a good night.
Thank you. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, I like working on the car. It's fun. You know, you get to go out there, and as long as it's not too hot or too cold, it's usually not too miserable. All right, Rich Rubino, our friend, he contributes to this. We talk politics with him, at least political history. He's like a professor. Forget about this forgiving student loan debt. Skip college. Pay attention to Rich Rubino. And from here on out, it'll be like getting an advanced degree in American politics. Overnight America, KMOX. Joining us now, contributor here on Overnight America, Rich Rubino, in his book, American Politics on the Rocks, The Bizarre Side of American Politics, which you can find on Amazon.com. Rich, thank you for coming back on to Overnight America.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to do it.
We got some big debates coming up, and there's a lot of people that want to be included in these debates. I don't even know if you can count on one hand all the Democrats that are going to be debating, because they have to split it up over a couple of nights. So as we look at some of the historical debates that have already happened, since we're getting back into the debate seasons and close to primaries and whatnot, what are some of those historical debate stories that come to mind to you?
You know, it's interesting because it's the candidate who always will give all the policy prescriptions, who will say, yeah, I'm going to pay for this, how I'm going to do this. That's not what most people remember. Most people remember those two or three zingers that happen in each debate. For example, you know, go back to 1984. So you had John Glenn, who, of course, a senator from Ohio, the former astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
And he was being braggadocious about all of his times in space and talking about all the accomplishments he made in space. And Senator Fritz Hollings from South Carolina looks at him and he says, yes, but what have you done in this world? And that's what was remembered because, you know, it's very easy to go. Sometimes candidates will go off on their accomplishments. Sometimes their accomplishments aren't necessarily political. It's, you know, what legislation they've authored, that type of thing. So Holland just looks at him and says, yeah, you've done all this. It's like saying, you know, I guess it would be like going after Jack Kemp, for example. With Jack Kemp, who was a former Hall of Fame football player, a quarterback for the Buffalo Bills. You know, Jack Kemp could talk about all the touchdowns he's thrown, but you could say, you know, does that really affect you in the political sphere?
Yeah. How do you even defend against something like that in a debate? Because once one of those sound clips get out there, one of those zingers get out there, it is crushing for a candidate to make up grounds after that.
Well, you know, actually, the best comeback I've ever heard. Now, you go back in 1988, you had Dick Gephardt and Al Gore. Al Gore, the senator from Tennessee, and Dick Gephardt, the congressman from Missouri. And at the time, both of them were, Dick Gephardt, rather, was trying to move to the left. He had come on as he started his career in Congress and a very conservative member of the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. He had since moved to the left. And Al Gore that year, he was kind of the last, I think, real Southern Democrat that was running for president, really ran and had a real Southern constituency. I mean, he would go to North Carolina and talk about how he had a tobacco farm in Tennessee and really show off about it, for example. So you had this line where Gephardt was trying to blast Gore for moving so far to the right, and he says to him, he says, when you started this race, you decided you need a Southern strategy. So you decided to do better to move to the left on defense and a lot of other issues. And he said, talking about Al Haig, who was Secretary of State in the Reagan administration at the time, he said something like, you know, he said, lately you've been sounding more like Al Haig than Al Gore, meaning he'd moved so far to the right. So that could be devastating in the Democratic primary. But you know what? Gore had one of the best lines ever. He looks at him and he says, and that line sounds more like Richard Nixon than Richard Gephardt.
Oh!
And how you think of that on the spot like that.
Oh,
I mean,
well,
that's either he knew that that was coming up, or that there was some sort of a semblance that was coming up of that, or he just was really good on his feet and he was able to think of that. So it was his retort that day that actually was better than what Gephardt tried to do when trying to go after him.
Yeah, that's memorable. Now, when you think back about some of those moments, President Trump, I feel like, is purposely trying to overflood or oversaturate when it comes to the zingers and the insults. And a lot of memorable moments from the debates came from when President Trump put those almost, you know, those zingers out there. And that's what people remember. One thing that you mentioned, too, you're right. Right now, what we're talking about, you know, we just had a congressional hearing on reparations. Bernie Sanders is going out there talking about forgiving student loan debt. All of those things are forgotten. You're right. It's the zingers. Those are the moments that people remember. I can't remember all the promises of the past debates. I just remember some of those select moments of watching the debates.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it's fascinating because I think the viewers look for this. I mean, it's, at some level, you have to ask the question as a viewer. If I'm sitting there looking for the zinger, I mean, how will the person who has the best zinger be the best president? You know, at some point you have to say, what's the connotation? How is it tantamount that, you know, for best example would be, I mean, Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, and when he was in 2008 when he ran for president, part of the reason that I think he moved up and became a front runner and actually won the Iowa caucuses was because he had a lot of great jokes during the debate. Like, you know, and people would say, oh, I really like this guy. And part of it too was he was likable. He was an evangelical, but he didn't come off as threatening.
Yeah.
Like, for example, remember Alan Keyes?
Oh, sure.
He ran for president a couple times, and he ran as somebody who represented the hard right, the social conservatives. And a lot of people that watched him were taken back by him because they viewed him as somewhat threatening, whereas Mike Huckabee, who had been a minister who represented social conservatives, did not come off that way.
Mm-hmm.
He actually came off as a very calming presence. His demeanor was very calm, and he had a lot of jokes, which I think really helped him. You know, I think actually his going on the Imus program, he went on Don Imus' show going back to his days as lieutenant governor, I think that helped to kind of mitigate the image that a lot of social conservatives have, that they're too threatening, that they're too conservative, that they're trying to, you know, theocratize the country. So at one point he's in one of the debates and he's talking about Congress spending. He said, you know, this Congress spends more money than John Edwards in a beauty shop. At the time, well, I say that because at the time they found out that John Edwards had spent $300 on a haircut.
Yeah.
And there's actually a tape of him on YouTube looking in a mirror and looking at his hair at the time. And it gave the impression, I think, John Edwards, that he was somebody who was kind of a prima donna, I guess, somebody who was so immersed in what he looked like that it kind of took over, I think, some of the substance. And I think that can actually hurt candidates sometimes. Sometimes candidates, I think of candidates like Evan Bayh from Indiana, or even Beto O'Rourke, candidates that I think are so focused on their looks, and I think sometimes candidates that can be somewhat appealing because of their looks, sometimes people will look at them and say, well, what substance do you have?
Uh-huh.
And I think that in that case, you know, that really, I think, hurt John Edwards in many respects. He gave a great speech, and Marco Rubio, too, by the way. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, he was actually on Mitt Romney's shortlist to become a vice presidential candidate back in 2012. He just got elected in 2010. He was a former Speaker of the House in Florida. And when he was running for president in 2016, he had a few lines that he remembered, and he would say, you know, he would be going after Barack Obama, and that's as Barack Obama did this, Barack Obama did this. At one point, Chris Christie, the governor of Jersey, looks at him and he says, you know, is that essentially, you said that seven times today, you know, is that all you have? And it gave the impression that Marco Rubio was a robot, that someone had implanted in his head that you're supposed to say this statement. And then I remember I was in New Hampshire on the day of the primary, and there was this robot going around. They called him the Marco Bot. He just had Marco, and he'd just be rolling around like, you know, Marco Rubio's this robot. That's one fascinating thing that people do. Another one, another great scheme that they would do is Mitt Romney did this when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002. He was trying to get Shannon O'Brien, the Democratic nominee, to appear in more debates.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent out a chicken, a guy dressed in a chicken suit, to go to Shannon O'Brien rallies. And at one point, Shannon O'Brien starts debating the chicken. and that becomes the story. You know, you're supposed to ignore the chicken, but she actually goes up and starts, you know, debating him. And so you have the Shannon O'Brien debating this chicken, and that, of course, becomes a huge story, too. That's one of the things they do that they do that candidates will do sometimes is they will send out somebody dresses a chicken, and the person dresses a chicken will try to say, you know, why aren't you in the debate? Why won't you debate more? And it actually is a pretty good it's actually a pretty good political scheme because you're getting yourself in the news.
Yeah.
And you know another thing that actually go back to 1994 now. So Newt Gingrich, that was the year of the Republican Revolution. The Republicans took over the House of Representatives first time in 40 years. And Newt Gingrich that year spent his time in 125 congressional districts campaigning for other Republicans. So Ben Jones of Cooter fame, the former actor from Cooter who served two terms and who was actually a former House Representative member of the House of Representatives in Georgia, mm-hmm. Followed him. This is his opponent in his own district. Followed him to one of his campaign rallies with bloodhounds.
Wow.
He was following with a bloodhound saying, "We've been looking all over for you in Georgia." And so we figured you're not in Georgia. So we'd go to Kentucky and other places, and he'd follow him, and he'd get a lot of national attention based on that. I'll give you one great line. Bill Weld and John Silber were debating governor of Massachusetts back in 1990. And John Silber basically said that we've created so much wetland because of beavers that there wasn't any need for humans to really deal with the idea of preserving wetlands. So Weld looks at him and he says, "Would you tell us, doctor, if you have any plans in terms of how you would preserve open spaces in Massachusetts?"
Wait, say that
again.
"Other
than leave it to beavers."
Leave it to beaver. The Democratic debates are coming up this week. There's two nights of it. I wanted to talk more with Rich Rubino about some of those debate moments throughout political history next on Overnight America KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. I'm your host, Ryan Recker. And of course, Mondays, we catch up with our political contributor, Rich Rubino. I love learning more about history of politics and some of those moments that really shape the way politics are today. And with the Democrat debates that are happening this week, I wanted to talk to him about those debates in political history. You can find his book, American Politics on the Rocks, on Amazon.com. I like these goading of the other political candidates where they go in there and they really try to invoke some sort of reaction from them. And there's been a lot of those moments, too, in recent years. And a lot of times it's just a political stunt, obviously. But when it comes time to having a candidate that may be really low in the numbers, if they're doing some certain polling, what a stunt is. They always resort to it in order to try to rocket themselves up onto the same platform that the person they're running up against. And, you know, you see those things, and sometimes some are more desperate than others. You know, I wanted to go over what may be one of the biggest debate moments of all time, going back to the 1988 vice presidential debates.
Oh, yes.
Yes. This has to be one of the most popular debate lines ever used, which, of course, is, you know, "Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy." Is there a more memorable debate moment than that?
Well, just some background on what happened there. So the Democrats had nominated Lloyd Benson, a senator from Texas, who'd been in there. He actually was first elected in 1970 and actually beat George H.W. Bush, who was running as a presidential nominee for the Republican Party. So he was running, and the Republicans, Bush's vice presidential nominee that year was Dan Quayle. And Dan Quayle had done this many times before. He'd gone around the country and said, because people were talking about his political experience, saying that he didn't have enough, he was too young. He said, "I served more times in the House and the Senate than John F. Kennedy." So Lloyd Benson thought that maybe he was going to try to do this again in the Republican, in the debate, to try to show that he had the experience. So Dan Quayle essentially did that and gave Lloyd Benson the perfect perfect opening to look at him, and he said, "Senator, I knew Jack Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I served with Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. And Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy."
Yeah.
And the fascinating part of it was he did serve. He was in the House, and it's true that he served with them, but they weren't really that good of friends.
Maybe exaggerating a little bit. His
friendship with that, but it made Dan Quayle, I think, look small because, you know, that was one of those selections that you have to be careful of, because George H.W. Bush, the presidential nominee, he had some problem with his conservative wing of the Republican Party that year. A lot of the Reaganites were for Jack Kemp, who was running in the primary. Jack mm-hmm. Kemp, the congressman from New York, who had actually one of the authors of the Kemp-Roth tax cut, which was the basis and the fundamental framework for Ronald Reagan's tax cut. So a lot of the conservatives, Newt Gingrich, Trent Lott, for example, had supported him in the primary. And there was also some conservative supported, some social conservatives supported Pat Robertson. Bob Dole had run that year. El Haig had run that year. Pete DuPont from Delaware, the governor, had run that year. So you had other. So you had the Republican Party was kind of split, and he was trying to bring back the Reagan coalition. So he decided that what he would do is he would try to get a young conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose Dan Quayle. And actually, it came down to, believe it or not, Dan Quayle and Senator Danforth mm-hmm. of Missouri. That was one of the people who was on the shortlist that year.
Of course, yeah.
Who was more of a moderate figure. But he chose Quayle, and he said, I have to get other conservatives to come out for me because the conservatives are lukewarm. You know, he would, for example, this is an interesting story. When Bush became president, Reagan had always put National Review in the waiting room in the White House. He took away National Review and put the Yale Alumni Magazine,
<Is that right?
laughs> which probably didn't help. But that was a great line. You know, Bush actually had a great line too. And in 1988, part of him beating Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts, the Democratic nominee, is he went after Dukakis in Massachusetts. For example, he got the support of the Patrolmen's Union in Massachusetts. There was the whole Willie Horton thing. There was this organization for George Bush that talked about Willie Horton, who had been released on a furlough program, went down to Maryland, and essentially raped somebody in Maryland. And Bush blamed a lot of that on their furlough program, and then he blamed it on the Massachusetts miracle. The economy had been in extremely, extremely good shape, was starting to go into the doldrums right at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And another issue he had was Boston Harbor. So there was pollution in Boston Harbor, and Bush went up to Boston Harbor and he'd have ads, and he'd say, you know, this is what Dukakis is doing on the environment. So during the debate, they asked Dukakis a pretty generic question, an innocuous question about what he would do about the soaring national deficit. And he gave an answer that was kind of, serpentine. He gave a very complicated answer. And then George H.W. Bush looks at him and says, "Is this the time for one-liners?"
Whoa, time for one-liners?
Then he actually said that. Then he says, that answer is about as clear as Boston Harbor.
Oh, no. I like that he sets it up. So he had his clear setup that he knew, pay attention, everyone. I'm about to give you a line. Is this the time for one-liners? I love that. All right, so that was President Bush during that election. It seems like the focus on debates, we put a lot of emphasis on that sort of thing. We look at it for entertainment anymore, where people get up and scream and yell, and you go to these town hall meetings, and people really don't want to, I guess, necessarily sit back and hear what the politicians want to say. But then again, I know the politicians aren't really answering anything that's relevant. They just want to make sure they get their base riled up or whatever it is. So I guess it works both ways when it comes to these public gatherings anymore. Now, with all of the different debates that are coming up with the Democrats right now, if you were to look at the wide range of people that are running, what kind of advice would you give to the candidates so they don't make these mistakes that you've seen in the past?
Yeah, in terms of, let's start with the front runner, Joe Biden. The biggest thing is you're ahead, not to make a gaffe. Now you can do that to the extreme. However, for example, Thomas Dewey, when he was running in 1948, tried not to make any gaffes, so he would give speeches where he essentially said nothing other than something like, "The future is ahead of you." And then Truman comes back with, they didn't debate back then, but Truman came back in another rally and said, "Yes, the future is ahead of you, and it won't be under Republican leadership either." So he kind of made fun of the fact that he was trying to say nothing.
Mm.
In Biden's case, I think what he has to do is, I would say, own the experience thing. Don't try to do what Bob Dole did in 96. There's a lot of similarities between Bob Dole and Joe Biden because they're both basically career politicians. Dole had been elected to the Senate in 68. Joe Biden had been elected in 72. I would say own it and talk about the accomplishments that you've made in the United States Senate and say, yeah, I'm a career. Don't necessarily say I'm a career politician, but say, yeah, I have experience. Instead of saying the word politician, say I've devoted my life to public service.
Mm-hmm.
You can specifically talk about how, if I were him, the whole James Eastland thing, that James Eastland is a senator from Mississippi known as a notorious segregationist. And he kind of showed off that he had had a relationship with him, that they were able to get stuff done in the Democratic caucus, even though they disagreed. And one thing that I think he should bring up, he should say that the first time he ever met James Eastland, and he was talking to James Eastland, James Eastland said, "So, Senator, what brought you to the United States Senate? Why'd you run?" And Joe Biden looks at him and says, "Civil rights." Mm-hmm. So I would own that. I would say, yeah, and then I'd say, but then I was able to work with Senator Eastland on other things, and as opposed to trying to kind of deflect on it. So that's what I would try to do there. Now, in Elizabeth Warren's case, what she has to do is she has to become the liberal alternative to Joe Biden. And in order to do that, there are a few people that she has to cross, and one of them is Bernie Sanders. And what she has to do is she has to somehow prove that she, first of all, that she's electable. There's some people who have this idea that she's not necessarily going to be electable, that the Native American heritage thing is going to bring her down, that she's going to galvanize Republicans. She has to say that, and during the 2016 senatorial campaign, she was sent around the country in 2014 as well to campaign for Democrats in parts of the country where that are right now inhospitable to the National Party, including, by the way, West Virginia. You know, West Virginia's Senate candidate actually invited her to campaign for her. That's something a lot of Democrats nationally would not be allowed to campaign for. They would not send a Democrat nationally to campaign in a state race because they're trying to distance themselves as much as possible from the National Party. Now, how does she do that? What she talks about specifically, she's a senator from Massachusetts, and she lives in Cambridge, which probably, other than San Francisco, is the worst possible place for a general election electorate to be from. You're going to be seen as these elitist connotations. What she has to do is present herself from where she came from. Say, look, I came from Oklahoma. I have three brothers who are in the service. I came from a very poor town. I paid my way through college. I went to a commuter college. I became a teacher. Then I became a lawyer. Then I became a professor. I did it all by myself. And say how she's trying to do that, how she wants other people to accomplish the American dream the way she accomplished it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the worst thing that the worst misconception people are going to have about Elizabeth Warren is that she was born at Harvard, and it's very hard. As I say, Harvard's got to be the worst place, other than, you know, Nancy Pelosi. I don't think would ever be a viable national candidate simply because she represents San Francisco,
right.
And it's so easy for any Republican to say that's a San Francisco liberal.
Oh, yeah.
If she was from anywhere else in the country, I think she would be a viable. You know, people would look at her as a female presidential candidate because she represents that one congressional district. People look at her and they say San Francisco liberal, which is kind of ironic because, you know, she's somebody who didn't even enter politics when she was 46 years old and had kids, grandchildren, actually lived a very traditional lifestyle. So Elizabeth Warren, she also has to emphasize that she talks about manufacturing jobs, she talks about trade deals, she talks about issues which can appeal to blue-collar voters, specifically in the industrial Midwest and Pennsylvania, in Ohio and Wisconsin. The people who had voted for Barack Obama but then were attracted to Donald Trump for his economic populist message. In terms of other candidates, I would advise Jay Inslee. You know, he's become a one-issue candidate in terms of climate change, but that's an issue which strikes a resonant chord with millennials. Mm-hmm. So if he just continues to emphasize why he thinks that should be the main focus of his presidential campaign, I can see him getting a lot of support. And I would also go after directly Tom Perez and the Democratic Party, because Jay Inslee was one of the candidates who wanted there to be a debate simply on climate change.
Hmm.
And they said that they could, essentially we can't have it on every single issue. So Jay Inslee needs to emphasize that issue specifically, which he's doing, and needs to say that we need to have a debate. And I ask you to write the DNC and to say we need to have this debate.
Mm-hmm.
Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, she needs to emphasize that she's the only candidate in the race that is emphasizing a non-interventionist foreign policy, bringing the troops home from abroad, and she's against regime change wars. She can say these other candidates up here may be against an individual war, but I'm essentially the one that's against all these wars, and I want to bring the troops home. And, you know, she needs to emphasize that, and I think that her audience isn't necessarily only Democrats. It can also be in some of the open primary states, New Hampshire being one of them, where Republicans can vote for a Democrat. She can get some of the Ron Paul supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Ron Paul, who ran in 2008, ran in 2012, he ran as a libertarian Republican, but he was somebody who said that we need to bring the troops home from abroad. And a lot of Democrats actually were attracted to that message, even though they probably disagreed with him on 99% of the other issues.
Well,
so that's what I would emphasize if I were Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah.
In terms of some of the other candidates, Eric Swalwell, his main issue, his flagship issue, seems to be gun control, but he doesn't seem to be gaining any resonant chord. If I were him, I would probably, if I don't get into the second debate, and he's actually said this, he might drop out and run for re-election. You know, he's 38 years old, and why he's risking all this on a presidential candidacy, I can't quite tell.
Mm.
And the other ones, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker. Cory Booker has to emphasize his charisma. He has to emphasize the fact that he came from a relatively well-off family, and chose to live in a poor neighborhood of Newark, New Jersey, because he wanted to be like what his future constituents, how they would act, and he would live in that neighborhood. That's something which I think can be a very can be very compelling. And finally, the candidates, you know, who aren't in the debates, they can be winners in this debate, in this as well. The candidates who didn't make the debates are Mike Gravel, the former senator from Alaska, Seth Moulton, the congressman from Massachusetts, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, and I'm missing one, and yeah, and Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, they can. And the mayor of Wayne Mason, the mayor of Miramar, Florida, they're going to be in. They're going to be all going to be in Miami. So they're in Miami, and they can go around Media Row and get a lot of debates. They can, I mean, they can get a lot of interviews, rather.
Oh, sure.
So they're going to be there, and all these other candidates, you know, if you're Eric Swalwell or Tulsi Gabbard, you're going to be up there with nine other people. Steve Bullock, specifically, is going to be, he's governor of Montana. He can go around and say, would you like to interview me? And I've seen other candidates do this. I've seen Dennis Kucinich do this, for example. And he can go around, he can get a lot of interviews, and people are going to say, well, why didn't you make the debate? And then he can say, well, I actually made the second debate. Because it was just that I entered late. And the reason he entered late, and this is a great story that he can emphasize with Democratic voters, is that there was a legislative session in Montana, and he wanted to make sure that Medicaid expansion was passed through the Republican legislature, and he got it passed. So he can say that I've been doing my job, and I did, and because I was doing my job rather than campaigning, I was able to bring Medicare expansion to my conservative state of Montana. And, oh, by the way, in my conservative state of Montana, where Donald Trump was just elected by 20 points, that same day I won by 4 points, and I got 25% of the Trump voters, so I'm a very electable person in the general election.
Yeah, they got to find what they can do to ease their way into these sort of things. They all have to find their own edge, and that's fascinating. You know, if people wanted to check out your book, American Politics on the Rocks, pretty easy. They just go to Amazon.com. They can find it right there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And Rich Rubino, I love catching up with you on Mondays, and there's so many great things in this book. But the thing is, history is being written every day. There's always something new going on. That's why I love checking out.
Well, like Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Yes, it does. Rich Rubino, thank you so much for coming on again to KMOX.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to do it.
Looks like we'll be hooking up with him again later this week after the debates that the Democrats will be putting on two nights in a row. Whoa, boy, doubleheader, huh? It's Overnight America, KMOX. Overnight America continues. All right, so SpaceX is in the middle of another one of their launches, and I'm watching it now. And this happened about, I don't know, 10 minutes ago or so. It's about 81,000 people watching this online, close to 82,000 people live just on the SpaceX YouTube page. And then there's other news agencies that are covering this that they're watching over there. I mean, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people online at 1:52 a.m. our time here in St. Louis watching SpaceX. Now, they're the company that is trying to privatize space travel. They're the ones that have found a way to reuse different rockets, which cut down on the price of sending cargo to space. They have the larger rockets. They want to send people to space. He wants to colonize the moon. I mean, Elon Musk is one of those revolutionary type of guys, a big thinker. And he's the one that says, you know what, let's just do it. He is the one that'll say, let's just do it. So I have the mission up. And part of them reusing their rockets is they have to retrieve them in a way where they can get to them. So a lot of times, if the rocket's going up and whatever tank they're using will just kind of split off and go into space or crash down into Earth and be unusable. But he said, well, we could put these rockets on the rocket and we can find a way to stabilize them and land them on targets. So when you have a launch out of Florida, the Kennedy Space Center, a lot of times you're going to be shooting off into the distance and it's going to be over water. So if a rocket tank breaks off and it's going to fall into the ocean, it's nearly impossible to try to retrieve it unless you have your own target. And what he's created were these, I don't know, like these ships that have like what looks like a helicopter landing pad on them. And the idea is the rockets are going to, after the fuel tank breaks off of it, fall onto this gently through its own rockets like it's landing a helicopter kind of. Well, I was just watching here, and it didn't go so hot. Let me play this for you, because this is what happens when it doesn't go as planned, and it comes down like a fireball and crashing. You ready?
Stage one landing burn has started.
All right, this is them watching it live.
We have confirmation that the center core landing burn has begun.
All right, so it looks like a helicopter pad.
See that coming down on Of Course I Still Love You?
There it is. It's trying to land, and oh!
A pretty good view.
Whoa!
And as you can see on our screen, it looks like our center core did not make it on our drone ship, Of Course I Still
Love You. All right, so it did not make it. So what it looks like is this thing trying to land. It looks like it kind of drifted off to the edge of this landing pad. And since it's on the water, the edge of the landing pad goes to water. It hits the side, the thing crashes, and it's a giant fireball. I don't know how much that costs. I'm going to guess that probably cost them $500 million or something. I'm gonna guess it's somewhere north of $100 million that crash just cost them. All like that. And they're like, oh, shucks. It didn't work. Oh, phooey. So tough. But this is, it's so cool to watch these things. Like,
always a little bit tense as you're waiting for them to confirm that the signal indicates that the door is open. Inside of each of the deployers.
Oh, that was 57 million? I thought it was over 100 million. 57 million they just lost. All right, so now that we're looking at a live video in space while they're waiting to deploy these satellites, it's so cool to watch this stuff. If you want to see it for yourself, you can go to youtube.com, search for SpaceX, because it's doing a live stream right now.
Until we get to the next deployment.
All right, so they're getting ready to deploy again. This could be very time-consuming to sit and watch this thing. Yeah, SpaceX, this is the same company that launched up their owner, Elon Musk's car, his convertible Tesla car into space, and launched that up there, which is kind of cool. All right, you can be watching this all day, I get it. But what's going to happen is tomorrow, if they do make headlines, it's going to be that one crashed and burned. So that's going to be the thing. Everything else looks like it's been successful so far. That'll do it for Overnight America. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Recker, a very easy place for you to conveniently message me when the show is not on the air. That's right. Anytime you can do it. You can also go online and listen back to any part of the show at KMOX.com/ONA. I talked about a lot of stuff. You can get it all right there. KMOX.com/ONA. Best thing for you to do, hit that subscribe button, and that way you'll get a direct link to the show anytime we put something up there. Enjoy the rest of your night. We'll be back again tomorrow. We'll see you.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.